What is up, group members? I'm one of your hosts, licensed psychologist Dr. Kristen Casey.
I'm licensed psychologist Dr. Jessica Rabin.
And I'm licensed clinical social worker Kristen Gingrich.
Today we kicked Justin out of this podcast so we could talk about women's mental health. Let's
Girl
go. No, Justin ditched us because he had way better plans. So we'll miss him. But settle in, take a seat, and welcome to group therapy. So I know right before we logged on here, we were talking about women's mental health. And I kept thinking in the back of my mind, I'm like, I wonder how they are because we're all women. So how's your mental health?
I like how KV, I just snorted.
And like, we knew what she meant too. It's like weird.
I mean, we're way more stable than we were this time last year. So like, chef's kiss.
A win is a win.
But like, we're living in 2024. We're a lady in 2024. So we are unwell.
A lady.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know. There's, I think my mental health really just depends on the day and what's going on, what work is like, what my kid is like, what social media I am consuming, what news I'm consuming, overall. Because it's just, I mean, exactly like KBI said, we're living in 2024. There's so many things going on. We're all connected to our phones. We have access to all this information. And sometimes it just like wears on me, us, everybody.
Yeah.
Hey, Tam, what about you?
No, totally same. Same. I think it depends on what I'm consuming. But I was thinking back of like in 20... What was 10 years? I can't even do math on the fly. I'm trying to think of 10 years ago. So I had to think
2014.
Right?
Okay. Duh. So I was thinking about the state of mental health in 2014 with women versus now. And I don't know if to Jess's point, it's like more in our face with social media or if it's just as bad or just as whatever. But I'm feeling it too. Definitely feeling it too.
I want to note that I definitely heard you say sane instead of same. And I thought you were basically like, no, I'm sane. Like, unlike you. And then I realized.
Like, absolutely not. Out of all of us, you know, this time last year, I would have been that one. But no, out of all of us.
KB is like, I'm grown, you know.
We are
you're like,
healed.
No, we sane. And I was like, huh, interesting sane. Word choice. But
yeah.
Then you meant same with an M.
No, I don't think I'm ever, you guys know me, you know, you guys know me.
Talking about all of the things that impact women's mental health and all of like, whether it's social media, whether it's life, whether it's family, whether it's our own internal narratives, and just how sometimes difficult that is to manage our own mental health in a world, you know, being transparent that actively works against us in so many ways. I mean, if we want to take it far back, I mean, the word hysteria always comes to mind. We're taking it back to my good old friend, Mr. Freud, right?
Like, you're not even like wearing your Freud shirt. That would have actually been perfect to wear for this episode.
So much shit, nothing to back it up.
It would have been so good. I didn't think that far. Damn. But, you know, even just if we think back even that far, like, you know, the term hysteria and anything that went outside of what was supposed to be was labeled as hysteria. I mean, we saw this possibly at the Salem witch trials. We saw this at all of these different pieces across history where if a woman deviated from the norm, it was looked at as that illness and something very severe, even when it probably was not.
Totally. I even think too, like, I remember my grandmother telling me stories about like, she was quote unquote hysterical and she was quote unquote having mental breakdowns and stuff like that. And she was getting ECT treatments back then or whatever they were, you know, all because she was just stressed about like moving and she was dealing with trauma and like really like just thinking about stuff from her childhood. And it was coming out in this way where she didn't know how to cope, but everybody thought she was like mentally ill, you know, mm-hmm. but she just was dealing with some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's just looked at so differently now, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I think what both of you are bringing up is just like societal pressures and expectations that mm-hmm. play a role. And like you said, KBI, like if back in the days of the Salem witch trials, if you deviated from the norm, you were like literally put on trial as a witch, or like what they would throw you in the ocean. It's like, if you floated, you're a witch. If you drowned, you mm-hmm. weren't a witch, but then you died anyway. So, yeah, I mean, when I think of like societal pressures for women, and I'm sure we could have like a whole discussion about this, like one of the things that comes to mind is just like the expectations of mm-hmm. women and our certain roles. I mean, there's general expectations to, you know, be more submissive or polite or caring or the caregiver, things like that, that can definitely take a toll on your mental health, whether it's because you have internalized those pressures and that kind of goes against who you are, or like KBI, you were saying, you go against that norm and then people are calling you a bitch or aggressive mm-hmm. or whatever it is. I think of societal, you know, expectations of body ideals and like,
it's a big one,
how we should look and things like that. And so that contributes to diet culture and eating. Like there's so many women or femme specific societal pressures that I think really negatively impact our mental health.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, take it back to Barbie. And mm-hmm. I mean, the movie that just came out and America Ferrera's speech and how exhausting it is to be a woman. If you're listening and you have not seen that clip, I really encourage you to look it up, because it's this really beautiful monologue of just like, you're not pretty enough, but then you're too pretty. You're not good enough. You're all of these things that the world tells you, and that everything never feels enough, or you're then being told if you do something, it's too much. Right? We're too submissive, but then when you stand up for yourself, you're too bitchy or you're too aggressive. And there's never that middle ground that ever feels right. Because it's also the way that you're perceived. The amount of times that I have been called bitchy in my life, like I would be a millionaire if I got a nickel every freaking time I've been called bitchy. But the reality is like, yeah, there were probably times where I absolutely was being bitchy. Absolutely. And I will own it. But a lot of times that bitchiness is me standing my ground, mm-hmm. me setting a boundary, me not willing to compromise on a value or moral or choice that I made. And when that's looked at, then it's looked at as, oh, you're aggressive or you're bitchy or whatever. When the reality is I just stood my ground. When, you know, a man would do that, that's not what someone, I've never heard a man be described bitchy as often as women are described as being bitchy.
It's wild. It's so wild. Yeah. I think about this a lot in the workplace. Because mm-hmm. I've had some issues at work in terms of like, oh, like you're too, like trying to think of the feedback that I've gotten. It's like almost like competing with male energy, even though I'm not trying to compete at all, like literally mm-hmm. at all. There's room for all of us. But I've had colleagues tell me like, you're taking up too much space, or, you know, you're talking too much, or you're talking over people. It's like, you guys do the same stuff, you know, I'm mm-hmm. just, we're all doing it together, you know? Yeah. But I do think a lot of times it really depends on who's listening and who's watching. And that kind of dictates yep. the response that you'll get, because I know plenty of people who are, you know, all for women and they want us to take up space and thrive and all of that. And they don't have any problem. Like they might see it as like, are you being bitchy or are you, like you said, standing your ground? Absolutely. A lot of that depends.
Mm-hmm. And I also think it's how we internalize these messages too, that because too. Like I can think of times at work where I've definitely like set a boundary or stood my ground, and then I'll go back and like apologize for how it came across, which I don't need to do, but I know it's that internalized like, oh, did I come across too aggressive, or are they going to think I'm mean, which I know is societal internalization of the internalization of societal expectations. But KBI, just like you brought up earlier, just like that inner self critic or those expectations we set for ourselves. So we're getting pressure from society, family system, and then internalized messages, which usually are influenced by both, that definitely contribute to worsened mental health.
Absolutely.
And I was just going to say,
you know, those messages. And one of the things like that always comes to mind is the mental load that sometimes women tend to default into carrying, specifically in their households or their families. You know, I carry the mental load for my household. There are very few things that my husband is responsible for as far as those things. And I just carry the mental load. I carry the mental load for our child. I carry the mental load of our pantry. We just, I literally just had this conversation where my husband was like, what's for dinner? And I was like, he's like, there's nothing in the fridge. And I go, well, there's plenty of stuff. You just have to make it. And he's like, well, what is there? And I go, I literally looked at him. I go, you have two eyes that work. Go downstairs and look at the shelves in the freezer and make a decision. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's sometimes those pieces that it's like, he looks to me because I do all the grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. And that I am the one, I'm the all knower of everything, but I'm like, the shelves are there. You got two functioning eyeballs. They work.
But do they? It is. Last time he got a vision exam. I'm just kidding.
Don't even get me started on his vision because I will.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But that's the thing is like a lot of even if like pivoting even to motherhood, like a lot of mothers, and this term mental load tends to be towards mothers and parental figures, but it's for anybody who may carry that mental load in their families. But, you know, mothers tend to default to that. Mm-hmm. And that is the most common thing that I hear from women is how exhausting that mental load is and the impact that takes, something that is in a way invisible, and the toll that it takes on mothers. Because like, I think like, you know, I'm just not thinking for myself, right? I'm not just trying to remember what I like to eat. I'm trying to remember what my kid likes to eat. I'm not trying to remember the size of my clothing. I'm trying to remember the size of my kid's clothing and what season are we in? And do we think he's going to outgrow his shorts from last season? Or do I need to, okay, I got to go through those. And does he have enough? Oh, he needs a swimsuit. So I got to put that down. Like that's how our brains work a lot of the time when you carry that. And that's a lot.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, it's another example of not really being seen or heard, you know, as a woman in society, or even if you identify as a woman in society, and having to explain that to somebody, you know, like, hey, this is all that I'm dealing with and it's invisible and I'm still dealing with it. And one thing that I found extremely affirming and validating was, you know, my partner acknowledging these things for me or my friends, you know, like, hey, wow, that's a lot to have on your plate. You know, it's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. That alone could make another woman feel so seen. You know, and I know we do it for each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. But I, it got me thinking about another thing with women and the invisibility factor. Have you ever gone to the doctor and explained pain to a doctor? And I'm just going to leave that there. any pain that you've been experiencing. And I think that there's sometimes this tendency for people to minimize the things that women experience too, you know, especially when it comes to that stuff. It's hard.
Or blaming it on a mental health condition. Your chest pain is anxiety, or, you know, your physical pain is because you're stressed, or that happens a lot in healthcare. And
wild.
I used to know some stats off the top of my head. I don't, but like, I think it's like with endometriosis, and I can't remember, I'm making this up to our group members listening, but it's something like from sign of first symptoms to actual diagnosis, it's like 8 years or something.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Because
I've seen that.
Specialist after specialist. Same with like more chronic illnesses that are maybe neuromuscular or autoimmune. Like because it gets dismissed. I mean, there's a whole debate over if fibromyalgia is a real diagnosis or not. And it's like 95% women or 97% women, but it's highly comorbid with anxiety and depression. So there's like a whole camp of people that are like, it's really just your anxiety and depression manifesting as physical pain. It's not actually a diagnosis. Like, oh, I could. K10, you hit, I mean, you hit a point.
I knew this was going to just send Jess into an absolute spiral. Well, that's why I just like to start the fire sometimes.
You know? It's just sometimes like even in a physical health space, right? It still blows my mind in two things about health that blow my mind when it comes to women specifically is that an IUD placement does not require pain medication.
Tylenol. Take some Tylenol.
Take some Tylenol.
Or Advil or whatever it was.
No numbing, nothing. That was probably one of the worst outpatient pains that I have ever experienced. I will say, just to be transparent, when I had it first placed, I was 6 weeks postpartum. Everything was still a bunch of humbo jumbo down there, so it didn't hurt as much because your cervix and all of that mumbo jumbo. I will tell you 5 years later when I got it replaced, that was one of the worst pains that I experienced in an outpatient setting to the point that I didn't even come to this podcast. Because I was over in bed in tears.
You were trying to come. We were just like, lay down. Like, come on. Just relax.
I passed out from the pain and they were like, we can't insert it if you passed out. And I said, if you don't, I will not come back. Like, I'm not doing this again.
Blows my mind that there's no numbing. There's no nothing. Like, I don't think it needs to be. I don't know if you need to be put out for it. But like
local.
What if you wanted the option? What if you wanted the option? I don't know.
Yeah, it's like just, what if you wanted the? But like a little bit of lidocaine down there, that'd be real nice. I don't know if you can put it down there, but
like, we're gonna have somebody like call, message us, and be like, actually,
I don't know. This is not medical advice. Don't shove lidocaine up your hoo ha, but let a doctor describe that. But then the second piece is, you know, giving birth, and specifically, I think more C-section of a massive surgery, and you're required 3 days later to go home and care for a child like nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. As somebody that had one.
Wait, yes. Uh-huh. And even for me who I had a very non-complicated vaginal birth, and I was supposed to just go home and suddenly care for a newborn while my hormones are dropping and I'm a little nutty and like, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm just hoping for the, and they're just like, oh, baby blues. It's okay. And like, these are those pieces that just stand out to me, like two big pieces. Like when we're talking about the medical piece that like stood out in my kind of experience where it's just like, what?
Yeah.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then if we're thinking medical and then you think intersectionality of race, you know, we're three white women here.
Yeah.
I mean, there is plenty of research that, you know, talks about, especially women and thinking about childbirth, black women who don't get proper treatment. And I mean that, and that's, you know, systemic racism and all of these things, but you know, we're talking about women globally, but then you think intersectional aspects of one's life, race, socioeconomic status, other forms of privilege or other marginalized statuses, and that just compounds the mental health. Well, the societal pressures, expectations, dismissiveness, invisibility, et cetera, and then compiles on all the mental health concerns.
Absolutely.
So
I think that's I was just going to say, and I think that's super important to bring up. Like you said, we are three white cisgendered women. And I think that there are definitely, you know, we're speaking from that perspective in so many ways, but it is like, you know, knowing that even as cis white women, there's a privilege in that, in, like you said, in the healthcare field. And even then, that's even why is that even a thing? We know why, like we said, systemic racism, all of that, but the fact that those things are going to, those things impact accessibility to healthcare and mental health treatment and everything in between.
It's true. Cause I often think about the pressures that I feel as a woman. And then I think about Black women. And then I think about women, any woman of color. And then I think about women who are living potentially below the poverty line. Like, I just think about how deep it goes, you know, and then like with the lack of access to care and then the documented history of just being invisible in society when it comes to pain and needing medical care, you know, it's gotta be really hard.
And I know we've been talking about a lot of like societal pressures, expectations. So when we think of like women's mental health in general, like, you know, what they might seek treatment for or are diagnosed with more, what kind of things come to mind for you all?
I think about anxiety.
I think borderline personality disorder, because there's like, I mean, many people will talk about how more women are diagnosed borderline and more men are diagnosed narcissistic personality disorder. Where really is it more just stigma and stereotypes that are driving those diagnoses rather than true? Because if you think of like the core characteristics of borderline personality disorder with, you know, instability of self, instability of relationships, instability of emotions, going back to one of the first things KBI brought up about like hysteria and being histrionic and things like that, there's a lot of stereotypes about women that I think influence somebody getting a certain diagnosis, even with things like anxiety. I think women are expected to be more anxious or nervous or on edge than men, which I mean, then we could argue that that also speaks to stereotypes of men as well. But yeah, I think women are like twice as likely to be diagnosed with anxiety than men. And I think rates of depression are similar. Twice as likely to be diagnosed with depression than men.
Yeah.
I
was just going to say, I feel like we see that so many places too, in just different diagnoses, like that difference between men and women. I mean, we see that with that. We see it in neurodivergence. We see it because like being transparent, a lot of these studies and a lot of these, the research was built with men or boys and built around that. And so it's like, where does that actually look?
Yeah. And I think like one could argue that women are more likely to seek therapy. So maybe they're more likely to get a diagnosis, which is absolutely true. And I would argue that, you know, societal expectations, gender, genetics, like play a role in things like anxiety, depression. I mean, we could talk about trauma all day, like, and going back to what you just said, KBI, about studies on men. I think, you know, we think PTSD, well, it was, most of the studies were done on like war veterans, but we know that women and children are much more likely to experience some type of sexual trauma, interpartner violence and things like that than men, and absolutely can develop PTSD or other trauma symptoms from that.
Yeah. And then I think about how many women experience all these things and it just compounds and we just think it's normal because it's societal pressure, potentially going back to like the beginning of what we were talking about of like, you know, well, I don't want to be seen as, you know, hysterical, or like, I don't want people to not trust my judgment. It's just such a hard balance, I think.
Yeah. I mean, another, and obviously this is my worldview with what I work with a lot, but eating disorders, and that goes back to society as well. Especially we live in the United States, westernized, thin ideals. We started this podcast talking about like even just social media and access mm-hmm. to information being in 2024. Like there are so many things that, and I don't want to say these things don't impact men, like social media absolutely probably impacts men. There's different societal expectations for body standards for men and things like that. But for whatever reason, I feel, and this is probably my bias as a woman, that whether it's, you know, we carry that invisible load and that's compiling it, we're more likely to talk about it or seek help, but it does impact our mental health in so many more ways, I think. And it can look different for so many different people.
Yeah. Do you guys think that women cope with mental health differently than others?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said it like that. Well, my I was thinking
like it's like a dumb question because it's obvious, but like I don't know how else to ask it.
But is it obvious? Because I think there is still like internalized shame and stigma. Once again, going back to the intersectionality of different marginalized statuses people hold. But the first thing that I thought about is like women, and I'm pretty sure we've talked about this on this podcast before, are more likely to seek out that community. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel like, at least in my circle of friends, you two included in that, like I am much more likely to talk about when I'm stressed or feeling anxious or overwhelmed with my girlfriends than my husband would ever be with his guy friends. Like their group chat is not like our group chat. Like they're not talking about like, oh my gosh, like this thing happened, or I'm struggling with this, or, you know, motherhood this or parenthood this or that. So that was the first thing. That's why I was like, yeah, because I think one thing that women do well is seek out that community in general. Obviously there are individual differences. More likely to go to therapy, like we already mentioned.
Yeah. I was thinking a lot about like the community and reaching out thing. And I think it's, some people will say like, oh, do women just talk more, you know, or are they just like more open? But I think that we intentionally, at least I do, I intentionally seek out those connections like you do, Jess. So I do wonder if it's like a protective factor because we know that we'll have to talk or we want that support and it's healing for us. It's interesting to think about why.
Mm-hmm. Are there any specific things that you all do? Like if something that you're struggling with mental health wise is related to being a woman, whether that be parenthood or expectations or things like that. Like, I mean, K-10, you kind of alluded to this earlier, like talking to your partner about it, but are there specific things that you all have found that you do that help cope when your mental health is struggling specifically related to societal expectations of a woman? KBI is smirking. I'm scared what she's going to say.
I cry in the shower.
Can confirm because you've told me you do that.
No, I think like when I reach a point, like I'm at a very different place, like in my womanhood and my mental health now than maybe like I was like 10 years ago. And I would say like now, like I'm really good at like being like, like if I catch myself, I'm like, where did that come from? Where is that judgment? Mm-hmm. Where is that statement? Where is that thought? Where is that feeling? Where is that coming from? And sometimes it's coming from a real place of truth. And then we work with that. We cope with that. And sometimes then it's coming, like, I'm like, oh no, that's coming from some unrealistic fucking standard some man in an office made. And I'm like, okay, so what part? And then I ask myself, like, what part of this do I want to be true? Mm-hmm. Because like, I think that there are sometimes like those things can align with our values and I never, or like our those things. And so I never want to discount that, but it's like, okay, where can I still find a balance in this in myself. If this, if there's a piece of this that aligns with my values, what can I do so that it stays aligned, but that I'm also like, fuck societal standards.
Mm-hmm. I love it. We call it balance.
Hashtag balance.
Hashtag balance. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think it depends on the stressor and how deep it is. But if it's one of those like invisible things like we were talking about before, I do feel that the best thing for me is just being seen. Like, yes, I see that. You know, I see you. It is hard. my partner and I have gone through, you know, we've been together a while. And I'm like, if you are just able to acknowledge it and just recognize that I'm holding this, that means the world to me, you know? And he's like, but in the beginning, what is it? It's not going to fix it. What do you want me to do? It's like, I get it. And like, just acknowledge it, you know? Yeah. So that's helpful. And then reaching out to my friends who are women, you know, I reach out to you guys too, but, yeah, it's just, I think being seen makes me feel like all the invisible pressures are valid because I feel them so deeply, you know? And sometimes it's easy to say like, oh, is it just me? Like, fuck, like, do I, can I just like, is it just me? Like, I don't know.
Am I the problem?
Am I the issue? Yeah. Is it me? So I just, yeah, those are the major things. And honestly, therapy has been so helpful in helping me deconstruct my identity around this stuff. I give me a sounding board and another person's opinion too on like, this is a societal standard and it's unrealistic, or that sounds like trauma. Let's dig deep, you know, because sometimes it's hard for me to distinguish, or it used to be really hard for me to distinguish both of those. And now I feel like I can, but long-winded, but yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, definitely like reaching out to others is helpful, especially when it's stuff related to like motherhood. And I think a big thing for me also is boundary setting and deconstructing these ideas that like setting boundaries is mean or something like that, because especially, you know, in the workplace, and I mean, I mean, I don't actually know the makeup of like, gender in my hospital system, but we do, working in pediatrics, I do work with a lot of like female physicians, and, but there's also, I mean, medicine historically has been a male dominated field. And then, you know, obviously in psychology, it's more, female dominated, but like learning to set boundaries and being okay with like standing my ground, exactly like you said, KBI, I'm recognizing like that's not me being mean or bitchy or anything like that. It's just me holding a value and I don't know, setting a boundary and things like that. And kind of like you said, KBI too, just asking myself, where is this thought coming from? You know, whether it's, you know, a bad body image day, or whether it's like, I don't know, the shoulds or enoughs coming up. Like, is this an internal thing for me, or is this me taking on societal expectations and trying to challenge those things? Know what else we challenge? That's a horrible transition.
Well, the Google Scholar Shorts challenge us, so I see where you're going with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Justin has
see you trying.
Yeah. Thank you all.
Justin's going to listen to this back and be like, what, y'all?
What happened? I'm editing half of this podcast out. Okay. So we briefly mentioned this. We can have a broader discussion on this from this conversation, but we mentioned that women are more likely to experience intimate partner violence. So how do you think types of intimate partner violence impact various mental health outcomes? So like physical, sexual, emotional.
I mean, I feel like they all would impact it negatively.
Good answer. Good.
I'm trying to be more specific.
No, I appreciate that. Good. So this is a 2024 meta-analysis. So the aim of this study was to assess the magnitude of the association between types of intimate partner violence and mental health outcomes, as well as shed light on the large variation in IPB prevalence rates between low to middle income countries and high income countries. So I'll add some results in about that, but I didn't know how to ask a question that incorporated both. So some stats from the study, the prevalence of having experienced any intimate partner violence in the past year was 24.2%. And I should have clarified, this is all on women. With the pooled prevalence lifetime of any IPV being 37.3%, with perinatal women reporting the highest prevalence at 28.8%.
I wasn't expecting that.
Wow.
Like, if I hadn't known some information before, but like, yeah, yes, we could talk about that in a second. Psychological violence was the most prevalent type of IPV in the last year at 27%. And the lowest prevalence reported was sexual IPV at 10.1%. And then physical was 15.7% in the past year. Experiences of physical IPV were associated with the highest increased odds of depression. Sexual violence was associated with the highest increased odds of anxiety. Physical IPV was associated with the highest odds of suicidal ideation. And lifetime experience of any IPV was associated with a fivefold increase of suicidal ideation compared to people that didn't experience interpartner violence. So the study also examined differences in IPV and country income level, which I just wanted to add some results because I thought it was interesting. So prevalence rates differed significantly for any IPV and all subtypes by country income levels. So the highest prevalence of any IPV in the past year was reported in low and middle income countries at 41.2% compared to 18% in high income countries. Similar patterns were seen for lifetime IPV, which was highest in lower middle-income countries and lowest in high-income countries. And then the association between any lifetime IPV and depression varied significantly by country income levels, with the strongest association in upper-middle-income countries. Wow. So things that stuck out to you all. I know I shared a lot of results, but it was a really interesting study.
My only response to that entire thing was, no wonder why we choose the bear.
Oh, so part
like,
of
like
me
hearing those
chose
numbers,
this study.
Like hearing 25, hearing 40%, hearing all like.
Yeah. Part of me chose this study because that discourse has been going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like also, and it was a really interesting study, but like that was in the back of my mind.
It very much is.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking with the like higher rates in low to middle income countries, and I wonder if part of that is because it's harder for women to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we hear that a lot, even in the United States, that is supposed to be whatever. but yeah, people don't leave relationships that have intimate partner violence because they can't. They're trapped. Because a lot of them, it's not only physical or sexual or emotional abuse, it's financial abuse and things like that. And I don't know. That was just a thought that I had. Like, you know, is there not an out for them? Or what is the stigma around divorce? Is it possible to leave?
Yeah.
And K-10, I know you had a strong reaction to the perinatal women.
Yeah. I was just thinking of like, what a trapped feeling. You know, because there was a law that was recently passed in Missouri for women who are pregnant, they're not able to get divorced. And I don't know all the grave details of the bill and the law that was passed, but just reading the first couple of sentences, I was just like, oh my gosh, you know. So I even think if those women are in potentially dangerous situations, you really don't have a way out, you know, and it creates this feeling of like, obviously I'm stuck, you know? So I was just kind of thinking deeply about how that might impact women now, you know, and how many women experience this and don't talk about it. You know, it's good to bring it to light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing that really stood out to me, I mean, a lot stood out to me, but like lifetime experience of any intimate partner violence had a fivefold increase of suicidal ideation. And we didn't share this earlier, but we do know that women attempt suicide at higher rates than men. I mean, men die by suicide at higher rates. But I think that speaks to what we've been saying, that trap feeling. I mean, maybe a lot of self-blame. Like, what have I done wrong? Or like, I'm not a good enough partner for this, and that's why I'm being treated this way. Or what we know about a lot of abusers is they abuse and then they love bomb. And then they, so then it's like, oh, well, he was just, and I'm saying he, obviously not all men are the perpetrators when it comes to intimate partner violence. But if we're thinking in like opposite gender couples, like, oh, he was just having a bad day, stress, things like that. But look, bought me flowers or told me how much, and that's perpetuates the cycle of staying in relationships.
It makes it hard to leave. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And question your own reality.
Yeah. I was reading a lot on IPV when I worked at the VA, because I worked with a bunch of women who experienced it. And I was reading, and I don't know how true this is, so I'm going to have to double check, but the rate in which violence occurs when you're in a situation like that, it increases when you're making plans to leave or when you're trying to leave, you know? Yeah. So it's like it even puts you at a disadvantage to make plans to get out of that situation too. That is just as dangerous as staying in it sometimes. So it's hard. I think it puts women in between a rock and a hard place, really.
I absolutely agree. No, it doesn't put us between a rock and a hard place. The polls? I don't know.
Do they? I don't know. I did the polls this week. I feel like I haven't done them in forever. I hope everybody enjoyed the behind the scenes photos that I found and added. They were pretty great. This will forever be my favorite for photo of all of us is us.
Oh, yeah.
Just for people who are just listening, the photo of us just jumping Justin on the ground. It is my favorite. So we asked everybody, the first question is, what do you think is the number one thing that impacts your mental health as a woman? Someone said, beside the fact that America hates women, I don't know. That was from Tina. Thank you, Tina.
Oh, Tina. We didn't even touch on that, side note, like just like reproductive rights and legislation and things like that, which could be a whole.
That's a whole other episode.
Which, yeah, I mean, it could be, but absolutely. Pay gap wage. I didn't say that right. Anyways, continue. Thanks, Tina.
We can circle back around. People just said, hearing, oh, you just need a break. It's so much more than that. Significant hormone shifts. Other people's expectations that you can't be emotional without being on your period. The patriarchy. Body image, societal expectations. There's a lot of the mental load. A lot of hormones. There's lots of talk of hormones. And, you know, I keep seeing fucking society.
Which so is what is we that. Talked about majority of the discussion.
Have you ever experienced gender-based discrimination or harassment that affected your mental health? The answers were yes, I have. No, I haven't. And I'm not sure.
I'd say yes is number one. I'm not sure is number two, followed by no, I haven't as number three.
Yes, I have, coming in at a cool 72%.
I don't know whether to be like sad for everybody or just
validated. Checks out. I mean, logically, we all know it checks out.
Yeah.
Sad, right? Dialectics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dialectics here. Again, this is my favorite little video of us singing in the backseat. We were singing Buy You a Drink. It was a solid, solid time. Have you ever felt your mental health wasn't taken as seriously because of being a woman? Yes or no?
I would say yes.
The resounding 90%. Yes.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's going back to like healthcare, like pain being dismissed as mental. Like, I think it's a weird dichotomy because in some situations, I think women's mental health is blamed for things. But in other situations, it's like, ugh, well, you're just like being emotional. or are you on your period? Like, it's mm-hmm. so weird.
It, like, you can't do anything right.
Yes, it goes back to that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, you know, we're going to blame your mental health for this thing over here, but when you actually have a mental health problem, we're going to just blame it on your hormones or you being a woman. Yeah.
So then I asked, what is your favorite thing about being a woman? Let me tell you, mm-hmm. when I say, which I love because I think that there is this societal piece of like that women don't like each other. There is so much in this comment section that is the sisterhood, the friendships, like being able to connect with other women, you know. Someone did say getting to sit to pee, you know, solid. To each his own.
When you have a long
to
day.
To each his own.
Yeah. Yeah. Who wants to stand? Who wants to stand? I don't know. I mean.
But guys technically can sit, I guess, right?
I guess. Drunken women in bathrooms.
Oh.
I've never seen someone be more of a hype woman than a drunk woman in a bathroom.
That's where you make your best friends
forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they compliment you on how pretty you are.
I have never
and how
felt
much
more beautiful
love
than in a bar bathroom with a bunch of drunk women.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a lot of just not being a man.
Oh, I don't know why that is so funny to me.
When I say there's at least 12 of those in some version.
I'm
looking for some funny ones.
Like, what is it about not being a man? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Do we start the list?
We're sitting to pee. Somebody already started it for us.
Sitting to pee. Yeah.
See, I would. That's the only thing that I probably would like about being a man.
Wait, why?
What, standing to pee?
Yeah, if I'm in the woods.
You're never relaxed. It's a cop out. You need to know.
But yes. So, but there is a lot of just the female friendship, women supporting women.
Yeah. I've met so many more women that are encouraging of other women than the opposite. You know, I've met so many beautiful, amazing women. I really haven't encountered that much. Maybe in high school, you know, and stuff like that. But it's just been so nice meeting other women, you know,
it's so interesting. Like even looking at that, like meeting other women, like as a grown adult, because when I mm-hmm. was like 21, I was like, I don't like other women. They're
you were one of them.
I'm just gonna be
that
friends
does not surprise me.
I'm gonna be friends that with guys. My two best friends were guys, and I was like, fuck women. Ugh, I'm
was a pig.
And now I have built some of like the most beautiful relationships with women, two of them being like on this podcast and like being able to say like that I like love these relationships with women and love being able to connect with them and sit in that space of really like K-10, you've said this a lot, like being heard and connected and just being able to connect in a way that like I was denying myself at 21.
Yeah.
I somehow mm-hmm. thought having guy friends was the best shit ever. And looking back, I'm like, oh.
It's a multi-layered concept there.
Why? Why? But like, but again, now like having such amazing connections with women in my life. Like,
oh, yeah.
That's just so huge.
I love it. And no, I feel the same about you, and I'll just speak for Jess.
I love
she probably
you.
Probably doesn't feel the same way because she talks a lot of shit about you. But anyway.
Yeah, Jess hates us all. Jess is like, fuck these dumb bitches.
She's like, get me out of here.
I'm like, where's Justin? Because I'm a man.
Where's Justin? Wait. I'm a guy's girl over I'm here.
Oh my God. All right. Let me get
I just want to know, KBI, if you talked like that at 21, or that's how you imagine you talked at 21.
Yeah, that's exactly what my Pennsylvania accent sounded like. I'm just so frustrated about these girls.
Oh my God. We would know. I can't.
but know what right. we can with.
Let's get to the group member questions.
But you know what we can? The group member questions.
Our transitions are horrible.
I think that that's what our group members love.
I love honestly. It too. I love it too. Oh my gosh. Okay. We got a lot of really good questions. So as always, you know, we used a lot of your questions to guide our discussion. So thank you so much. So we're going to start with Jay from Australia. She asked, as women, I get spoken over and dismissed all the time. How can we be assertive without being seen as bitchy or a nag? I hear this a lot.
See, I've just accepted that people are going to see me as bitchy and naggy. And it's about how I see myself. Because there are some times I will acknowledge that I am being a fucking nag to Ben. I'm like, I'm just fine. But I'm like, that's what it is. But the reality is like, am I nagging or am I just asking for what I need? Mm-hmm. Am I nagging or did I already ask 5 times and that person still not have completed it? And I've given ample time between each question. Like, I really just go back in that mindfulness of like myself, because the reality is that you're not going to stop someone from thinking you're bitchy or a nag or any of that, because that's their perception. And I'm not saying, and I don't want to say that that like may not hurt or not feel good, because absolutely. But I've really stepped into that place of like, at the end of the day, like, do I feel that way? And if the answer is no, then I'm fine.
Yeah. I
pause really quick.
No, I was going to say the same thing, KBI, about like, I think it's more about other people's perception of you as like bitchy or nagging. I stitched this video on TikTok like 3 years ago, but it's like resurfacing. And I think it's a really good example of how like women are invisible. But it was this Black woman who has her doctorate degree, and she was on some type of Zoom meeting where her knowledge and expertise, like she was invited as a speaker, and the white man, so we are talking intersectionality again, introduced her as Miss Rosario. And she was like, it's Dr. Rosario. And he was like, oh, I apologize, Miss Rosario. And she was like, it is doctor. And she stood her ground and she was like, I would not refer to you by your first name. Or, you know, a lower title. And she was like, I earned this and I deserve to be called by it. And, I think that's just an example of like, yes, I'm sure a lot of people perceive that as being bitchy or a nag, but she was asserting her title, which in that context, like she was the invited speaker to talk about something in her field. And I think, you know, learning to use your voice and power, and it can be scary, but knowing that the more that you do it and the more that you stand your ground and do it in a respectful yet assertive way, like people may still perceive you as such. But I like to ask myself, like, would somebody say this if a man said it? And if the answer is no, you're not being bitchy or a nag.
I like that. I'm going to keep that in my back pocket. We got a lot of questions about hormones, PMDD, puberty changes, pregnancy, all this stuff. So overall, there was a bunch of questions. So the first one is kind of like the major one, the explanation of PMDD and the impact it has on women's mental health. I guess I wanted to start too with, have y'all ever had clients who've had that diagnosis?
I have not.
I have
not. But primarily because I work with actually, now that I say that, I may have had one ever. I mean, I was going to say, I have my DSM per usual pulled up. If we want to,
I was
going to
say, I can't PMDD remember what the letters stand for.
Premenstrual dysphoric disorder.
Yeah.
So, the diagnostic criteria: in the majority of menstrual cycles, at least 5 symptoms must be present in the final week before the onset of menses to start to improve within a few days after the onset of menses, and become minimal. I'm emphasizing those because they're emphasized in the DSM, or absent in the week post menses. So one or more of the following symptoms must be present: marked affective lability, so mood swings, feeling suddenly sad or tearful, or increased sensitivity to rejection, marked irritability or anger, or increased interpersonal conflict, marked depressed mood, feelings of hopelessness or self-deprecating thoughts, marked anxiety, tension, and or feelings of being keyed up or on edge. Criterion C, one or more of the following symptoms must additionally be present to reach a total of 5 symptoms when combined with symptoms from criterion B. Decreased interest in usual activities, subjective difficulty in concentration, lethargy, easily fatigability. I didn't know fatigability was a word. Or marked lack of energy, marked changes in appetite, hypersomnia or insomnia, a sense of being overwhelmed or out of control, and physical symptoms such as breast tenderness or swelling, joint or muscle pain, sensation of bloating, or weight gain. The symptoms from criterion A to C must have been met for most menstrual cycles that occur in the preceding year, which I understand we have to have a time limit. But reading that also just kind of goes back to what we were talking about with the healthcare. Like, so you have to have this irritability and depression and anxiety for a year before we're going to tell you.
I just. Actually. Yeah, after a year. If it's 11 months, get out of here. You know?
Yeah. 11 months, you're just being emotional. Yeah. You're just hormonal.
Yeah.
And then, like all other criteria, like causes significant distress, things like that. So the way I was like taught and always conceptualize it is like it is a significantly heightened version of PMS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's how I've been explained it as well.
So I guess going back to the question we received from Sierra, like how does it impact women's mental health, depression, anxiety?
Yeah.
And I think it can impact, at times it can impact daily living.
Like, absolutely.
It's just that, like we said, like it's take your PMS symptoms and times it by 10, 15. And it can, you know, I do have a friend who is diagnosed with this and they will tell you that week is like hell week.
Mm.
It's like batter down the hatches because I have to really, really work at not causing like a divorce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
and I even think too, like just on what you just said, if you already have depression and anxiety and then just say you have PMDD, like how that might feel for that way. You know what I mean? It probably feels, gosh, like unbearable for some people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. My gosh. We got another question from Cindy from Brooklyn, about birth control and its effects on mental health and vice versa. So let me see.
I feel like I have heard, again, not a medical professional by any means, but I feel like I have heard individual, like doctors prescribe birth control to help manage the hormone dysregulation.
Mm.
But I also know that sometimes you can have a reaction. So like for me, like I was on a birth control and I had a reaction that caused severe dysregulation.
Mm-hmm.
It made my hormones go off the charts. But I know that they sometimes will try that to help regulate some of those because you can kind of like it, your body doesn't have you don't kind of go through that cycle in the same way, especially if you have a pill in it, you take it back to back and you never have a period. Your body may process hormone. Again, not a medical professional, not super educated in it, but I feel like I have heard doctors prescribe it for that.
Yeah. I the only things that I know are from like personal experience or just friends. I was taking a birth control. My gosh, I was so young. And I remember like for the first couple of months, it just didn't agree with me. Like I just started to feel like sluggish and weird and all that. And then when I went off of it, I felt fine. So I don't know if it was just me. But I did have a friend who was using it for, you know, regulating her period, acne, stuff like that. And she had such a severe reaction from it in terms of like her own depression getting worse. And then I've heard of people with their depression getting better. So I think it's all to say like, we're not medical professionals and everybody has a different response potentially. But I do wonder if there's more research out there about it and how it affects mental health.
Well, I do know that like estrogen and progesterone, mm-hmm. I can never say that correctly. Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
Shifts can impact mental health. So like, yeah. I mean, that's why we see, going back to something KPI said, like the baby blues the first 2 weeks after giving birth, because your hormones tank after having a child. And so like you feel more depressed, anxious, angry. But once again, exactly like you all were saying, I think it really depends on the individual and their body and how they respond. Because just like you all shared, like I've had experiences on birth control where it doesn't impact my mood at all. I've had friends who've had horrible experiences, friends that have had like wonderful experiences. And then I guess you could also take it a step further rather than like just the hormonal birth control itself, like, you know, is being on an IUD minus the pain and stuff like that, bettering one's mental health because they really don't want to have a baby. And they're like, okay, now I don't have the stress of potentially getting pregnant. Or if they're using hormonal birth control for acne and their acne is clear, now they're feeling more confident and then their mental health's better. So I think there's so many different ways. Like, yes, hormones itself can impact, especially the like plunge. I don't know if that's actually a medical term. Like if you're taking, I'm thinking of like the pill and you have like the 28 days of the last week that are sugar pills, like that plunge can impact your mental health negatively. But I also think indirect benefits or consequences could happen as well.
Totally. M from Canada, they asked, what are your thoughts on seeking diagnoses for neurodivergence as an adult woman? I've had a lot of my symptoms dismissed as just anxiety or just depression, but it seems like there's a larger pattern going on.
Oh, I mean, we talked about this right before we hit record about specifically like me, being late diagnosed ADHD. And looking back and all the symptoms were there. The poster child for ADHD is a 7-year-old hyperactive boy. That is the poster child for what the world has identified as ADHD. When the reality is, you know, hyperactivity is one of those pieces, but hyperactivity could be physical, but it could also be mental. So a lot of my hyperactivity comes in being, I will say the physical aspect comes in being chatty. Sometimes I don't know when to shut the fuck up. And my brain going, never stopping. But then there's also the other part that people forget about ADHD is the inattentive, which women tend to fall more into the inattentive versions. And so, but we don't, that's not the poster child. And so I think that we are, because of that, we don't see that as often. It's the same with autism. And I know neurodivergence covers a different, but even how autism looks in women versus what it looks like in boys as well. And, you know, in 2024, we're getting better at it, but yeah. I think that there is a very big gender difference and it's really starting to be pointed out.
Okay. Jeannie from Pennsylvania asked, what symptoms show up differently in men than women? Also, I know there's often issues with women being treated differently than men when it comes to physical health. Does this exist in the mental health space as well? Part of my voice this entire episode, y'all, I have the worst allergies right now ever. But yeah, I think that a lot of symptoms show up differently in women than they do men. And is it because of socialization? Is it because of expectations from society? I mean, it's just so hard to say, but I even think of anxiety. When I'm experiencing anxiety, it looks one way. And when my partner's experiencing anxiety, it looks completely different, you know? And those are just two people, but any thoughts on maybe symptoms that you've noticed that just show up differently?
I mean, I definitely, and as a reminder, my worldview is mostly children and adolescents, but I think, externalizing occurs a lot more in men or boys than women and girls. So like depression, may show up more as anger and irritability in those assigned male at birth versus for those assigned female at birth, it may be that like withdrawal, tearfulness, things like that, anxiety, or like we talked about earlier, like the difference in diagnosis rates between like borderline personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but if we look at rates of diagnoses, like are we more diagnosing based off of stereotypes rather than, I don't know, actual symptoms? And with regard to being treated differently in the mental health space, I would like to think not, but I also feel like that's a very biased thing to say as a mental health professional. And like, no, because like, I'm like, or do I? And I just have blinders on.
I was saying, no, it's important to think about and to bring into the room and acknowledge, because I think that, you know, a lot of us have blinders on and we don't realize it, right? But I think we're hoping as a mental health field that we don't treat women differently, you know? I think that's kind of the intention and maybe the hope, but I'm sure it happens, you know? Okay. I think we have time for one or two more. So this came from Anonymous. As clinical psychologists and social workers, how comfortable are you treating individuals with perinatal mental health symptoms / disorders? I'm studying to be a clinical psychologist. Yay. Welcome to the field. And I want to specialize in this area. And as a woman, it's scary to see how little mental health providers, psychologists and psychiatrists and reproductive health providers know about or how to screen for these, particularly for perinatal anxiety. Do you know if there's screening tools beyond EDPS or EDPS for perinatal mental health? So basically like how comfortable are we with treating this? And my first knee-jerk reaction was I don't really have much experience. If I'm being honest, I've worked mostly with adults, but I haven't really worked so much with perinatal mental health. What about you guys?
I would say my experience has been my personal, which has then driven my better understanding. I think that they're like my mentality, and this is just my mentality, that if you have a client on your caseload who becomes pregnant, that you should have some, that you should do a smidge of research. You don't have to go get trained in perinatal mental health. I don't believe you don't have to suddenly change your niche to meet your client. But I think that if you do not have any education around what any of that looks like, you should seek out some of that basic enough to say, that's a red flag. I need you to talk to your doctor. That's a red flag. I think you might need to talk to someone who is trained. Now, there are perinatal professionals who do not have that training. That's a whole goddamn other issue. But I'm if I'm going and seeing my therapist, like who I saw through my whole postpartum, I'm not expecting her to be trained in postpartum. But my hope is that she was screening things, which she did. She did. And had a little bit of knowledge. I am not trained. Even in this job that I'm currently in, I had a client give birth to a child. And it's not my role to ask about her, but I asked about her because I said, I want to make sure that you're okay as well. And if you need additional supports, then we can get you those. But my job is not to coach you or counsel you through your postnatal care, but I'm a person here coming into your home. And so I don't think we do enough screening. The first doctor's appointment half the time after you have a child for yourself is 6 weeks after. Like,
yeah, I was going to say all the people I know that specialize in perinatal mental health got that specialized training after they graduate school. Like, I don't know a single person that is in the field of perinatal mental health that got that training in grad school. Like, most of the people I've connected with online or my therapist that I sought out after I had my daughter, got the training after they became mothers themselves, and realized that they wanted to specialize in this. With regard to other screening tools other than the Edinburgh, I don't know of one. The Edinburgh is what we used when I used to work in pediatric primary care, because we would be the first point of contact to screen postpartum moms. I think the other thing, and this is just my bias, because somebody's probably going to listen and be like, oh, there's all these other like tools and stuff. If you look in the DSM, like postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, things like that are not official mental health diagnoses.
They're specifier.
Yeah, exactly. So like, and unfortunately, when it comes to screeners and assessments and things like that, it needs to be where like you have to have funding and research and money and things like that. But no, yeah, the Edinburgh doesn't account for anxiety, OCD, trauma. It's a depression screener. And like we talked about with when we were talking about PMDD, like none of us have treated it, because we haven't seen clients with it. But I think, you know, if that's what you want to go into, definitely do it. I know like Postpartum International and some other websites have formal trainings and things like that. Seek out clinical experiences that would provide you with that training. Because I know that I remember years ago, my OB told me, because I go to the OB within my hospital system, so like they know I'm a psychologist there. And he was like, I really wish we had like a psychologist in our OB clinic, because he was like, that could be so helpful for so many individuals coming in. But unfortunately, I don't know, this is what I was going to say, so pessimistic, and I'm still going to say it anyway, but I think it goes back to women being invisible and where's the funding coming from and like the training and stuff. Like, we're not going to spend time in grad school talking about perinatal mental health when X, Y, and Z are considered more quote unquote important topics. But Anonymous, I'm so glad you want to go into that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Go Anonymous. Really. Last question from Amelia. She's from New York. And she said, how do you ladies feel about medications not being as effective for women because they are only tested on men, specifically ADHD meds? I actually didn't know that.
I didn't know that either until I saw the questions. and then
this is like,
I mean, my hope is that, you know, in 2024, things look a little bit different. Again, like specifically ADHD, if we go back 25, 30 years, you know, because it was more of the boys' diagnosis, obviously that makes sense. My hope is maybe it looks a little different now. But I don't know much about that.
Yeah. I mean, because I didn't know that until I looked at the question. So I did look it up, and there is some research on the fact that ADHD meds are not as effective for women, and may actually increase like, depressive or ADHD symptoms, specifically going back to bringing up period in the premenstrual week. So interacting with hormones. I found another study that was like kind of mixed results. I think it was a review of 14 studies. Sorry. No, there was 21 studies and 14 were effects of pharmacotherapy. All of them found at least one sex difference in the effects of ADHD pharmacotherapy. There's also differences in things like boys being offered medication more frequently than women, and things like that. So hopefully, like KBI said, in the good year of 2024, hopefully we can move forward and do new studies and figure out, I don't know, how to treat women. I mean, just with the increase, bringing back another question with more women seeking out diagnoses of ADHD, mm-hmm. autism, things like that later in life, hopefully that will drive better research and better treatments. Well, all good things come to an end, unfortunately.
Girl party over.
And I just want to thank you all for joining us for today's episode. We hope you learned a lot about women's mental health, including societal expectations of women, how menstrual cycles impact mental health, and disorders that are more commonly seen in women than men. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Share this episode with a woman in your life who may need to hear it. And we will see you next week in group therapy. Bye.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Peace.